Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
All right, Mind Pump listeners.
Listen here, little motherfuckers.
Whoa, that's the wrong way to talk to our listeners. Coming in hot. We love you guys.
We interviewed a very interesting individual.
Let's be honest. Some of them are motherfuckers. Yeah. Anything about it?
So are you. You're about to listen to us interview Zach Bitter. Zach Bitter is the holder of the 100-mile American running record. You heard that correctly.
Yeah, 100 miles.
100 miles.
At one time. That's not like over the course of a year.
Yeah, like I've run 100 miles too over the course of 37 years. But he, this is, what was the pace? Like it was like a 7-minute mile pace.
Yeah.
That is insane. Miles. Can I just say that's the part that is unbelievable to me. I can't even right now. There's no way.
And he maintained that.
To run a 7-minute mile. You have to be in fucking great shape.
Just to run 1 mile.
7-minute mile.
Yeah, you're in good shape.
Yes.
He ran that 100 times in a row.
Yeah.
He basically ran the equivalent of three 3-hour marathons all at one time. I mean, it's insane, this guy's level of endurance and performance, but he's very interesting for other reasons as well.
Yeah.
Zach is one
very
of the...
Very fascinating guest.
He is part of a very quick, fast-growing minority in the athletic world of athletes who eat low carbohydrates, who are fat adapted. He eats a pretty much ketogenic diet most of the time. And so he talks about that and why other athletes are now adopting this type of diet.
Interesting insight he puts in there.
Very, very interesting. He's a very intelligent guy. The way he approaches his training, his understanding of nutrition and exercise.
It's obvious why he's a world record holder.
Yeah.
It's obvious. His level of that he's gone into as far as studying with his nutrition, his program design. I mean, it was one of my favorite interviews, actually. For a guy who prides himself on never doing cardio or running ever in my life.
I know, right?
He was probably one of my favorite guys to talk to because it was just so interesting to dive into his mind and his approach. Not to mention, it goes right along with everything that we've been talking about recently with sugar and carbs, because in the past, he would be the perfect example that they would pull from on why it would be ridiculous for you to do that, because they need carbs and carbs are so important and you got to load. Everyone, if you're an athlete or you're anybody who does anything endurance related, you must take carbs in. And
so that just blew that excuse right out of the gates.
It's fascinating. You can find him on Facebook, Zach Bitter. You can find him on Twitter as Z Bitter. Instagram at Zach Bitter, and his website is, you want to make a guess? Anybody want to take a guess?
What? Yeah. Is it Zach Bitter?
ZachBitter.com. You spell that ZachBitter.
He's bitter than you.
Without going into any more hubbub, here we are with Mr. Zach Bitter.
Right on.
First of all, we looked at your 100-mile American record. You kept up a 7-minute mile pace for 100 miles.
It's fucking crazy.
So I would have passed out on the first lap.
Well, I mean, I can't run a half a mile in 3.5 minutes. So you did 100 of them in 7 minutes. That's insane. But it was on a track, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, they do this event down in Phoenix, Arizona every year called the Desert Solstice. And it's basically like an ultra marathon track invite where you, I guess if you go there, you're trying to break some kind of record, whether it's an age group or outright world or American record. So that day I had good fortunes in the 100-mile distance, I guess.
Wow. And that's how many laps is that?
It comes out to be like about 402.5.
Wow, 400 laps in the same circle. Because when we were watching it, there's two things that we all commented on. Number one is the insane, of course, the obvious, the insane amount of just endurance, just total physical endurance.
Right.
But if the mental piece is
what were you focusing on?
Yeah, it's understated.
Like, is there a hot chick in mind? Or is there like something
he listens to,
you?
He listens to Mind Pump in his ears, is what I think you told me.
Is that what I get, little earbuds?
Okay.
For sure. Yeah, you can definitely listen to music and stuff on them. One of the things, you're right about the mental aspect of it. It's definitely like, even different from other 100 milers that are more traditional, like on the trails where you can kind of like take in the landscape or things are changing like every place you go or every like hill you climb. Whereas on the track, you kind of have to try to mentally separate yourself from that, because once you start counting laps, that's when you're going to run into trouble. It just gets overwhelming. So like in the training, even I would go to a track and do a run where I would progressively get faster and work on being able to kind of just mentally tune out and almost like meditate, like separate yourself from your body type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of like go around in those circles without actually like feeling like I was actually there.
Now, where do you go when you say you get out of your body? Like, where are you going?
Yeah. What do you mentally focus on? Like what takes you away from that?
Yeah. You know, it's hard. I think that's probably the number one question I get. And it's the toughest one to answer too, cause I don't always remember. Sometimes I'll just be like zoned out.
Almost like it's like dreaming then for you.
Kind of. Yeah. And then like, I think what oftentimes happens is I kind of think of the same thing over and over again, and then it all blends into one thought at the end, and then I start thinking like, well, I only thought about three or four things that whole time, but really it was like the same thing over and over again that just kind of kept popping up. But
I would be very interested to see what your brain waves look like while mm-hmm. you're doing that, because it almost seems like the way you're explaining
like autopilot.
Well, it seems it's almost like a dream state or even a meditative state is mm-hmm. what it sounds like.
Saying. Definitely you would fall in the line with like a meditative state type of thing, and that works well as long as you're hitting the splits you want to hit and it's coming like naturally and not like having to either artificially push yourself too fast or slow yourself down. And where I noticed it got the most difficult was when I started falling off my pace, and then I couldn't really zone out, because if I'd zone out, I'd be slowing down too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start counting laps a little bit, and you start everything starts catching up to you a little bit. So it's definitely, you know, split more like 70 miles, 30 miles, or 80 miles, 20 miles in terms of like the halfway point.
Wow. So they said it was like 8 hours of consistent running, something like that?
The total time was 11 hours and 40 minutes.
11 hours, holy shit.
Which actually is, I think for someone like you, is no big deal, because I know my good buddy's a ultra marathon runner, and some of your guys' runs are like overnight. Like you guys run 24 hours straight in some stuff, right?
I'm pedestrian compared to what some of these guys are doing. Like there's these guys who do like 6-day events where they're like out there running for 6 days, and you manage things along the way. You decide when to sleep and when not to sleep. And I mean, there's guys who've done it and slept like less than 10 hours the entire time. And it's like
crazy.
Just think of staying up for 6 days mm-hmm. and only sleeping for 10 hours. Is not even just sitting around seems pretty daunting, but yeah, it's a goofy sport. And you kind of find like what part is going to draw the most like intrigue from you, and that's kind of what you focus on, because when you're exerting that much physical and mental energy, you've got to enjoy the process.
When did you know you had a passion for that? Where did this come from?
Yeah.
Stem from childhood, or did you get it later? Like, when did the bug hit you?
For sure. It was, you know, running in general was started early on, like middle school, high school age is, you know, like any boy that age, you kind of gravitate what you tend to be better at. And I found out very quickly that I was near the back of the pack if I did the 100-meter dash, but I could be in the front of the pack if I would do, like, the 800 or the mile or something like that. So I started kind of thinking, oh, maybe I should try cross-country. Maybe I should do the 2-mile and track instead of the 200 or something like that. And that's when I started to kind of realize that I had at least some talent in the sport. And then, you know, competing in college and stuff, I got introduced to, like, a high-mileage training mindset, and I really started to like that. Most of my college days kind of ended up being just really physically adapting to that, building that base, that structure. And then afterwards, that was my favorite part of it, was those longer, slower distant runs. So I did a lot of that and really developed like an aerobic base. And you know, that kind of, I turned my energies towards running races that kind of match that type of training style.
Now with all that training, you know, starting from, you know, going through college and up until now, were there any turning points? In other words, were there any moments where you changed something fundamental in your training or your diet or maybe your mental preparation where you were able to see a significant boost in your performance? You know, things that you may now incorporate now that you learned, you know, early on.
Yeah, for sure. Like we were saying before, basically what at one point I looked at kind of what I was doing in my training log, and I was like, you know, I'm investing 20 plus hours a week into this activity. And at the time I was a full-time teacher as well. So I started almost feeling guilty about it. So I'm like, I got to find a way to like double my time here and kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. So I started, you know, listening to tons of podcasts on both like fitness and nutrition and things like that. And I started looking at like how can nutrition really kind of like take you to the next level. And that was right around the time where like using fat as fuel kind of became a little more mainstream or well known, or at least it was information about it was more available and it wasn't completely like spat at by all the professionals. So I started kind of playing around with that, and I noticed right away it was one of those things where like you don't really always know if something's not wrong until you change it, and then you feel better, and you're like, wow. Like for me, it was pretty abrupt too. I like at first I didn't go like strict ketogenic right away or anything like that in my diet, but I definitely kind of flipped it all on its head. And rather than doing a typical endurance athlete protocol where you're like super high carbohydrate, I did the majority of my macros from dietary fats, and you know at least half of those saturated. So when I did that, I noticed I was sleeping better. You know, I wasn't waking up as much to like go to the bathroom. I was recovering quicker. I wasn't getting like as much swelling and stuff from hard workouts and stuff like that. So things seemed to be seemed to be clicking along a little better from that. So with that, I was really sold. And then it was kind of like, all right, I've got this base of like kind of idea of what works for me. Now let's sharpen that spear as much as possible. And like over the next 3-4 years, I really started to fine tune things by, you know, trying little things to change and stuff all along that same kind of concept where the high fat approach is going to be the fueling point for my training.
Very interesting, because the one category of athletes that have really started to adopt a more high fat diet approach seems to be the endurance athletes. I think that's you're still a minority with among your peers.
Sure.
However, it's much harder to find other categories of athletes that eat this way yet now. I think in the future you're going to see much more, but you guys have seemed to adopt more of the stuff. And I think it probably has more a lot to do with the fact that, like you said, the anti-inflammatory effects, they're going to be pronounced with someone who does, you know, constant repetitive motion like you. And then here's a second question I have, because you know, I know, you know, I've trained and I've worked with lots of endurance athletes, and, you know, they have to feed themselves during their long events. They have to make sure they refuel themselves with glycogen. And what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, at most, your body may be able to store, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 calories with the glycogen. But even the leanest athletes will have in the tens of thousands of calories, you know, 30,000 calories of stored fat energy that they could you know, use. Do you find yourself, you know, refeeding yourself while you're running differently or less now as a result? Does that change at all?
Yeah. And it's interesting. A lot of people will come to this approach because of that very reason. Like they'll do a 100-miler or something like that, and then they'll realize, wow, after mile 80, I stopped to use the bathroom 20 times. Something went wrong. I couldn't take my gels in anymore. And they realize that that's not a sustainable option for them if they want to meet their full potential. So they have to look at trying to find a way to not put their stomach in that place to begin with. For me, it was a little different. Like I always kind of had an iron gut, and I would be able to take in 400 or 500 calories an hour of basically pure sugar, and it didn't seem to really bug me too much. But then what I noticed is when I switched my macros around in my day-to-day life, I could do the same like level performance or the same energy output on 1 to 2, maybe 250 calories an hour. And then, you know, you feel a lot. Anytime you can keep your body from doing an extra task when you're already asking it to do a lot, that's a plus. So like I try to eliminate digestion as much as possible by doing that lower feeding during the event type approach.
Interesting. Now, are you still feeding with carbohydrates while you're doing these long runs? So you, in other words, you're eating, your macros are high fat, but then when you get into your race, because I know some endurance athletes, what they do is they eat ketogenic, which really sensitizes their body to insulin. Then they may load a little bit on carbs, far less than they ever did before, and then their refeeds during the runs or cycle, you know, whatever, is much, much less as a result because our body's utilizing more of those carbohydrates. Are you doing it like that, or are you refeeding with fats, or how does that work for you?
Yeah. I definitely have, like, just like with my training, I've got like cycles. So in a race, I'm going to allow it to burn off my body. Cause like you said, even when I'm at my very leanest state, you know, the leanest endurance athlete still has tens of thousands of calories that they can tap into from body fat. So for me to ingest a fat during a race seems counterintuitive. Because,
oh, good point.
Right, because I can just bypass the digestive tract altogether.
Very good point.
Fucking brilliant.
Yeah. So that's one less task.
You definitely have spent some time in this.
Fine-tuning it.
You could say I've done a deep dive. But yeah, so the interesting thing too is from what I've seen is there's at least some individual like variance from person to person where like when I really hit hard training, where I'm doing like two-a-days and doing some strength work and maybe some speed work and stuff like that. You know, carbs are definitely a faster-acting fuel source, and I don't feel like they should be eliminated, or I don't want people to come away thinking, oh, this guy hates carbohydrates, he's anti-carb. Because when I'm peak training and like really going hard, you know, I'll up my intake to 20-30% carbohydrate and fuel that higher-end stuff and just replenish those glycogen stores a little faster through those means. But then when I'm doing like a recovery post-race or doing just an easy block where I'm not going really hard, I'm just doing base miles, that's when I'll drop it down lower. Like I'll finish a race, then I'll drop it down to keto level, like 5% or sometimes less.
Wow. See, it's important for our listeners to know. Now, your high amount is 20% carbohydrates, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is low. That's low carbs.
Right.
And you are a guy who's running miles and miles and miles every single week. Mm-hmm. Now think of the average person who's usually sedentary, even if they go to the gym for an hour a day. They're extremely sedentary, and 20% of the calories from carbs will still be considered low.
Well, this is part of why we were so excited to have you on the show was, you know, this has been a recent message of ours. There's been a lot of stuff that just mm-hmm. recently in New York Times about the sugar. We just did a mm-hmm. thing from a TED Talk we watched. And so we've been trying to get this message across to people that we're not trying to tell people that like, oh God, carbs are so bad, stay away from them. But it's like getting people to realize how little we actually need them.
Right.
And mm-hmm. in the past, we used to always lean on the like, well, if you were somebody who trains really hard right. or an athlete.
You need that energy. Yeah, where are you going to get it from? Yeah. You need those carbohydrates.
And so that was kind of the pushback. And then everybody in their head justifies that they're some sort of a fucking athlete. And they, you know what I'm saying? So they right. need 65% carbohydrates. Yeah. So I love listening to you talk about how much more efficient and probably better you feel. And you said something earlier, I have to repeat it because we've said it before on the show, and I think it's so important, is that people don't realize that they were either one doing something wrong or less healthy for themselves until you find like
right.
the healthier path, right? You probably mm-hmm. thought you're kicking ass already. You know what I'm saying? You were doing just fine the way you were going. Mm-hmm. And then you make that switch and then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I feel even better than I felt before. Oh my God, I'm sleeping. And this is like a lot of people who ingest a lot of processed shit food all the time who listen to the podcast and say like, well, I'm not one of those. I feel fine. I feel healthy. I feel good. Well, maybe it's not that. Maybe you just don't know what it's like to your body to feel really,
you're
truly
used to it. You've adapted to that.
Well, an interesting thing too is like from my experience, there's like three things that people really get a kind of routine or dogmatic or just kind of like stuck on, and that's politics, religion, and their health or nutrition, their what they're eating.
We just said literally that on an episode.
We said you can't even bring up nutrition right. in the conversation anymore.
I know, it's that polarizing. That it's like debating Trump and Hillary, or you know, totally. Catholic versus Lutheran kind of thing. So it's you definitely have to you definitely hear a lot and see a lot. And like one of the questions I'll get too about that is, you know, someone will say, well, yeah, but you know, you're doing these ultra endurance events where you're at that like zone one, zone two aerobic state at like the majority of the run. So you can do that. And it's like, if you were doing a fast 5K or something like that, you'd have to go super high carb. And, you know, my thought about that is that, I mean, I would definitely restructure my kind of cycle the way I described before. But even if you're doing like a 1500 meter, there's a huge aerobic base that's developed throughout the year for that. So like the way I would approach it would be the same way I approach my training. I use fat for fuel for the aerobic stuff. And then when I need that high octane fuel, I turn to the high octane fuel, and that's sugar.
Well, there's been several studies that have shown that athletic performance, they did this with male gymnasts, it was okay. Not only was it okay, but it was the same, if not a little better, on a ketogenic style diet. And they also now found that athletes who are fat adapted, believe it or not, have just as much glycogen stores within their muscle as other people, because the body will make all the glycogen it needs from your protein.
For sure.
So it's pretty interesting. But one thing you said that was fascinating was that you noticed less inflammation in your body when you switched over to eating that way. And I think it's important to note the just the pure oxidative stress on the body that any extreme sport or any extreme endeavor will do. I mean, you're training for a high level of performance. You're not training for just overall health and longevity.
For sure.
And so oxidative stress and damage and inflammation are huge factors for you to consider. Mm-hmm. And you said you noticed less pain. Like, what do you mean by that?
Some of it was just, it was really, really subtle, where it was almost like you notice what you don't notice kind of thing, where, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and then instead of having my ankles swollen, they would be like, you know, they'd be like, there'd be no swelling in there, or my feet would have like veins throwing up like all over the place, as opposed to just being having this like puffy foot from being on my feet all day the day before. Stuff like that, little things like that. Recovery too. The biggest thing I noticed early on was like when I was the high carb approach, I'd do like a 50 miler really hard, and then, you know, I would, after about 3 days, the muscle soreness would have subsided, but it would be about 2 weeks before I felt like really good running again. Like I would be able to run, but it'd just be kind of like slow plodding, or like, you know, like I wouldn't really have any desire to push pace. And then when I switched that on its head and like really lowered that oxidative stress I was causing during the event and in the days after, I noticed I'd still take that 2 to 3 days to kind of let that muscle recovery occur. But then after that, it's like I could almost do a speed workout like 5 days after, where like that pop was back, that inflammation had been flushed out. Like there wasn't any of that like chronic lingering around type of swelling and stuff that really is the majority of anyone's muscle pains. And the muscles heal quick. It's getting all that other crap out of there is so the hard part sometimes.
That goes into a little bit of what I want to ask you about too. The whole, I mean, I can't imagine how sore we were watching the video of you just, just like, give me a fucking blanket. I'm just going to sleep right here.
I was like,
I'm going to call it a night. I mean, to me, and I know we're probably going to offend all the other athletes in other sports, but we were all debating saying like that has to be one of the most intense, grueling things you could ever possibly put your body through. I mean, for that long, that hard, I mean, the level that you were pushing at, and then to see you afterwards, like, I mean, that literally you just want to just curl up right there. At the end, what is that like afterwards?
It's pretty crazy. You know, it ranges a bit. I've had events where like you finish and you don't feel good, but like you know, you're up and going. And even after that event, like, you know, the initial like response was like, all right, I'm done. This is over. I'm sitting down. I'm lying down. I'm not getting up until I want to. But, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I'm up walking around talking to people and hanging out and stuff. So, like, that's one thing that I've found the human body has impressed me the most with, is that, like, regardless of what you focus it on, it can get really, really good and it can adapt. So, like, and the nutrition is just a whole other aspect towards that, towards maximizing that ability for your body to adapt. But, yeah, you know, there's some, usually what I find is if I do a race that doesn't match my training environment is when I'm the most wrecked. So like,
of course,
going into that race, I did a lot of hard, flat, like road track type races. Mm-hmm. So the muscle pain wasn't too bad really afterwards. I was definitely sore and a little achy, but you know, a couple of days later I was fine. But if I had gone out and done like a race that was just like up and down, tons of eccentric contraction, I would have been just destroyed after that thing. Cause it's just different
stimulus.
Well, now going to the bathroom while you're doing that for, you know, 11 hours or whatever. I mean, obviously, if you got to take a poop, you got to stop. But sure, you just pee yourself, right? Isn't that what you do? I'm asking that because I have a friend of mine who does long endurance, and that's what she said. She's like, you just pee yourself, and
it's
you keep
probably
going.
Just pretty much fucking water. I mean,
you don't want to stop because it all counts towards your time.
Yeah, am I right?
Or?
It's interesting. You know, I've at Desert Solstice, I stopped twice to pee, And that's all I stopped the entire time. So it was maybe 90 seconds.
Wow.
And we actually talked about this on another podcast too. Then the guy was like, so if you were like right on razor's edge of breaking a record and you had to pee really bad, would you just like pee your pants? And I'm like, well, yeah.
Fuck yeah. For a record?
Dude, I would shit myself. No problem.
That's happened to people before.
Yeah. Oh, if they're like, you're about to break the world record, I'd be like, I'm taking a shit right now. Yeah. For two reasons. Number one, I'm about to break the world record. Number two,
but that's
I
got a
shit.
Sorry for the guy behind you.
That's a huge aspect of the 100-mile distance, and I think it really becomes kind of the dividing point between like a 100-kilometer or like a 50-mile race and then moving up to the 100-mile distance is managing your digestion, managing the bathroom breaks and stuff. Because like you said, if digestion goes wrong, it can go horribly wrong, and you can end up in the bathroom like and just realizing how is there that much in me? Like, where is this coming from? And you know, you hear stories of people like having to stop 20 some times in the last like quarter of a race and stuff, and they're just destroyed. And you know, that adds tons of time. And you know, I had an instance that happened to me once. I was doing this indoor track race up in Alaska called 6 Days in the Dome, and I was trying to go for the 100-mile world record actually, which is 11 hours and 28 minutes. And I ate something bad like right before the race or the night before or something, because like as soon as I started running, my stomach was already kind of off, so I knew it wasn't like just bad fueling choices during the race. And I stopped like 3 times in the first 30 miles and just like unloaded. And I was like, I remember thinking at mile 30, like, yep, that's everything. There's no way there's anything else in there. I'm good to go. 70 miles, let's just get this done now. And I focused more on liquid calories after that, just because I was like, that's going to be a little easier to absorb. And then I think I got to like mile 60 or 65 or something, and I started kind of thinking I was going to try to eat something like really small and sugary. Like I always try to really trickle it in slow, because I do rely majority on that fat adaptation. But I remember grabbing like a small handful of Swedish fish, and that just like turned my stomach upside down. And I like literally 15, 20 miles later, I shit the Swedish fish right out. They came straight out. There was no digesting of those things. They went right through me. So like you have those instances of stories. And you know, I think I ended up stopping like 17 or 18 times on that event. And you know, I ran 12 hours and 8 minutes. And you look at like the 17 stops, you know, and how much time that adds up. I mean, that's the difference between, you know, getting that time you wanted and having it be a little slower than you wanted. So like it's part of the sport, so to speak, but it's something that's very preventable if you get yourself to a position where like you can trust what your body's going to do and you know how it's going to react in certain environments and stuff like that.
Yeah, you don't want to introduce like new foods right before.
That would not be smart. What about leading up to a big event like this? Like, take us through what training and prep looks like for you, like during the week, you know, more so from your program design, like how many miles.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned speed training and like how you vary up your training. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So basically what I do is, you know, at the beginning of the year, I'll probably do maybe two, at the most three, what I would say in A races. So one where I'm going to be like, I'm going to taper for it. I'm going to try to peak for it, because you can only peak for so many things. Like I can do 6, maybe 8 ultra marathons in a year, but a lot of them are just basically hard workout long runs. So the ones I'm trying to peak for are the ones I'm building everything around. So throughout the course of the year, I'll probably do about 4 months of like, I guess you could call it like active recovery or just low zone one training, where I'm not really like, I just detach. I'm like, I'm not going to mentally stress myself out about getting this done. But I'm still running a lot. Like I average over 5,000 miles a year. So that's over 100-mile week. So even when I'm not training hard, I'm still out there moving around quite a bit.
Wow.
And then basically once I kind of have those A races identified, I structure the next two parts of the training around that. And that's the second block is kind of like this really high end aerobic, like zone two, or like if you're familiar, like there's this Maffetone heart rate training method where I do a huge bulk of my training at like a heart rate range. And for me, it's like I usually target between maybe 145 and like 155 to 160 beats per minute. And I do like a lot of workouts in that range. And that, you know, that for me, when I'm getting pretty fit, is between like, you know, if I go up to 160, you know, I'm well under 6 minute pace. If I'm at 150, 155, I'm at maybe just under 6 minute per mile pace. So, you know, those are some, it takes a while for your muscles to kind of adapt to that pace. So once I kind of get that part portion of it done, when I'm getting closer, maybe like 8-10 weeks out from the A race, I'll start really trying to like sharpen the spear, and I'll do like 400 meter repeats in the track, mile repeats, things you'd see more traditionally in like a marathon or sub-marathon distance training program. And what I find out for me, what that does is it just like makes my running economy way better. So then when I kind of revert back to those like zone two, like heart rate based training workouts, I notice that my heart rate is lower at any given pace that it was before. So it's kind of like that thing that pushes you past the plateau. And then, you know, you can only do that so many times before your body just like says, screw you. Mm-hmm. So you have to time it just right. And then, you know, you do your race, you recover, and you kind of like work your way back to that after that.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Any strength training as a part of your routine? Do you do any type of resistance forms of training?
Yeah. You know, I really loved weightlifting in high school, and then in college I continued to do it and stuff. And I was injured for like 4 months at one point in college, and I just like really, really got into the weight room, and I've just enjoyed it. So I've always tried to keep some semblance of that in my training. And lately it's been a lot more like kind of core strength, where it's like not like crunches or anything like that, but like you'd see a lot of the runners, they're like, oh, I'm gonna do some abs, and then you know they're just doing like these little like tiny crunches like on the grass, and it's like, that's not, you're probably just hurting your back. But you know, like a lot of plank work or like resistance band work to like kind of like really address my entire core. Like I'll grab like a foam roller and do like I like it because it's like the most bang for your buck, where like I'll roll out from my quad all the way down to my ankle, and it'll include like a push-up as well as like a complete abdominal like crunch. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that, like I do quite a bit of. I'll target lower leg strength a little bit periodized as well, where I don't shy away from the heavy weights during the base. And so like I'll do like some like deadlifting and stuff with fairly heavy weights, where it's like, cool, I'm only doing maybe 5 reps. Mm-hmm. And then when I get closer, I usually drop some of the heavy stuff out once I start doing the high intensity workouts, because I never want the strength training to kind of, that's like step two kind of. I don't, sure. if it interferes with step one, then I shouldn't be doing it.
Of course.
So it's always kind of trying to find that balance.
Very intelligent as far as training and stuff like that, and
well,
program design.
And addressing the posterior chain.
Yeah,
too,
no, I think that's
very important.
Yeah, no, I think that's fucking really smart. How common are you compared to everybody else? In other words, do you feel like a lot of your peers are just kind of gifted and talented and get after it, or are people starting to figure this out? Are there more ketogenic people? Are there more people that are training like you're training and program designing leading up? I mean, what does it look like for you as far as looking at your peers?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, there's definitely people out there who are taking like the professional athlete approach, and they're like, everything they're doing is like, how is this going to affect my end result? I wouldn't say there's a whole lot of people doing it the exact same way I am. You know, I've really, really preached that, like, you keep an open mind and you do your homework and you find what works for you. And you know, what works for me, and it's certainly worked for some of my coaching clients as well. But you know, some people, they need to go on that journey on their own and find out what works for them. And you know, the ultra running community is kind of goofy too, where like, some of the like intrigue for a lot of people is like this, like, more of a like relaxed approach to it. And sometimes that works out for people, because like, if, as I'm sure you guys know, like when you start stressing out about something too much or putting too many eggs in one basket, like that can be a negative thing too. Like then mm-hmm. then things start getting bad in your own head. And with a sport that's so mentally driven, like you do want to kind of, so you have to keep everything in perspective from that regard. I guess my personality kind of allows me to keep an eye on that. So like, I know I'm very, very dialed in, and but it's become such a part of my lifestyle and what I want to do that it hasn't caused a whole lot of undue stress from other areas that could cause if I were like, you know, trying to juggle too much at once. And mm-hmm. you know, some of it's just, you know, I'm super lucky too, where like my main sponsor, Ultra Footwear, also employs me to do some marketing in Northern California. So like my whole day and life kind of revolves around training and like teaching like a lot of like proper footwear, proper foot mechanic type stuff. So you know, with that and coaching, it's like I'm doing what I want to do. I'm doing my passion. So I can really minimize a huge chunk of what most people derive their stress from, like work. You
know? Wow.
Like a lot of people are just punching the clock, and that's stressful.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. So two things. So when I asked you about strength training, you brought up that you did a lot of core work. And it's interesting mm-hmm. to me, because when I've trained endurance athletes in the past, if we did a hard resistance training workout before they were going to do a long endurance type of training, let's say the day after, if I train a runner and I train their legs really hard the day before, mm-hmm. they could still run the next day. Yep. If I train their upper body, they could still run the next day. If I hammered their core, they were screwed.
Core
the next
and posterior
day.
Train.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had to be very careful where I would position, the core training, mm-hmm. Because it's such an important part
of
running. That and basically the lumbopelvic hip complex, right? Mm-hmm. Which we talk about all the time. But something you just talked a little bit about foot mechanic and foot strength and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Are you in the camp of the excessive, like the super cushion shoe, supported shoe, or are you more on the minimalist? And do you train your feet? Do you, besides running, are the things you do for your feet to make them stronger, or is that even something you need to worry about? Mm.
Yeah, definitely. That's I've done a lot of experimenting with that in the past, and currently do too. And I go, my philosophy kind of is in line with the founder of Ultra Footwear, who says you want your foot to do what it would do without a shoe there. But you sometimes want a shoe there to protect you from the environment. You don't want to be stepping on things Excellent. You shouldn't be stepping on. Mm. But you want your foot to be doing all these different movements, because you're getting these muscles in there that are going to atrophy if you don't use them. Just like you would go into a gym, and if you go to a gym for the first time in 6 months and you do a routine, even if it was something you used to do casually and not be sore, the next day you're going to be wrecked. So the same thing with your feet. If you put something on your feet that's not going to allow those muscles to be addressed, as soon as you do something where that's not there, they're going to be really sore. So my approach to that is I always want to have that really, really even playing, that zero drop footwear, because that's going to put me in a position to strike more naturally and kind of exercise those muscles thoroughly. Where I guess separate from the minimalist movement there is I'm not always super low cushion. I'll range the amount of cushion I do. I'll go from something that's really flat, no cushion, and really kind of work some of those muscles. But then I won't always go back out to the next day and do that again. Then I might use something that's got a flat plane with a decent amount of cushion on it.
Oh, so you'll actually rotate what shoe? Well,
it makes sense. Think about it this way.
It does.
If you go to the gym, what do we talk about with resistance training, right? You go in the gym, you work a muscle hard.
Yeah.
You can't keep hammering it, day after day. It's going to give it some time to adapt.
Right.
And the foot is no different. If he goes running in a very thin shoe, then it makes sense to have a little bit more support the next day.
And then you can really assess the environment that you're about to do your race in, too, mm-hmm. and adjust your foot, your shoe accordingly, right?
Yeah, I think people need to realize that when they embark on a journey of getting, their feet strong or whatever, it takes a lot of time, especially considering the fact that we've been put in shoes since we were able to walk.
For sure.
And most shoes are so supportive that we have, even the most developed muscular people, have got super atrophied, weak feet. I mean, one of our colleagues, Dr. Brink, pointed this out big time, especially me and Adam. We were over there and we were doing some assessment stuff, and he was showing me my feet are basically worthless.
Yeah,
they're
not contributing.
Well, we did a simple test. I will never forget it. And it was just he just wanted me to lift my big toe, and I'm like, I can't fucking do that.
And he walks. No, you can.
Yeah, he walks over and he's like, look, you totally can. The muscles are there. The range of motion is there. You just have lost the connection there because you don't.
It's crazy. And people don't realize too, one thing I didn't realize when I got into starting to pay attention to footwear, my first thing was what is this minimalist idea? And, diving into that and kind of figuring that out, or the natural foot movement thing. And then I really kind of got into the idea, your toes, you were saying, they need to be able to move like that so you can make that mind-body connection, mm-hmm. As well as, let your foot do what it was supposed to do. So having that room to let your toes splay out is just mm-hmm. super important. And even from letting those nerves that kind of run from your midfoot down into your toes relax and build up and keep the inflammation out of there and stuff like that. If they're just pinched up in there all day long, it's things are going to get inflamed, things are going to atrophy, and then you're going to, like you said, you're going to become kind of useless.
Well, what's interesting, so they've done studies on people and found just explosion of neural connections in the brain when people walk around barefoot a lot.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. You got to think about it this way, your brain adapts to sensory information. So the more things I touch, the more things I experience, whether it be walking on different terrain or experience different light, or I'm reading something or whatever, my brain will adapt and will develop. And one of those things, like the bottom of your foot has a tremendous amount of nerve endings, and constantly always walking around in shoes all the time means that you're not only have an underdeveloped foot, but there's parts of your brain, there's proprioceptive parts of the brain mm-hmm. that are not developed as well. And they find that people, when they walk around barefoot, they their brains develop mm-hmm. all these new neural connections, which will only benefit other parts of your learning and the way your brain processes mm-hmm. information. Do you ever walk barefoot? Is that something you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And I can't remember where I read this, but I remember somewhere mm-hmm. where some guy was citing something where it was like, even if it's just 15 minutes a day on actual ground contact, like foot to grass, dirt, ground contact yeah. is like really beneficial to kind of, and when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Like your body is a whole bunch of little things working together in unison to accomplish whatever you're doing. And when you're walking, that foot is the first point of contact. So it would make sense that in a perfect state, your brain is going to gather that first base of information from your feet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, the deeper we get into fitness and health, and the more we learn about the body, the more we realize that it's that if you stop fighting evolution and go along with how your body kind of evolved, moving and mm-hmm. Adapting, you're going to do better than trying to always throw, you know, cushions on it and, yeah. you know, crutches and supplements and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It kind of worked. I mean, and I was having this discussion with the boys before we came in when we were watching your 100-mile race. And I was telling them, you know, although we're very heavy into resistance training, we love building muscle. Mm-hmm. We love having, you know, big biceps and all that stuff. Humans, from a physical standpoint, there's only really one physical thing we do that's pretty exceptional in the animal kingdom. And that's trek. We can out-trek.
Cover long distances, yep.
It's yeah. correct, right? We can out-trek almost any animal yep. on mm-hmm. Earth, but the strongest...
Certainly Zach can. Yeah. 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 Well, I'm not sure if Justin...
We'll put you in that category.
I'm not sure Justin and I can out-trek anything right now.
What I always tell
certainly
people...
Certainly Zach can.
What I always
sprint
tell people...
Sprint and kill.
And I don't want to anger any of the bodybuilding.
No, go for it. Piss everybody off.
No. I do it all the time.
I love the bodybuilding groups and like the gym rats, so to speak, because like, I mean, you guys are always a step ahead of the science. Like that's where I go when I want to find out what are people doing right. that we haven't figured out works yet. And right. you guys are always cutting edge with that. So it's like a super intriguing group. And that open-mindedness from that group has been very beneficial for me. So like that's what got me intrigued with your guys' podcast in the first place. But like, yeah, so like I always tell people, like, based on like what are we kind of meant to do, like we could take an average or weak gorilla, take the strongest man on the world, that gorilla's going to destroy him.
That's exactly yeah. the that's exactly that's the exact, example that I gave.
That's the exact analogy Sal gave before you walked to the door.
That's funny.
We're literally talking about that. It's the exact analogy.
He said gorilla.
He said exactly.
You could literally take the most roided out, you know, gifted, you know, strength athlete in the world, mm-hmm. and he won't come close to yeah. a weak, average gorilla. But you take a human and you train, you can train any human mm-hmm. for a decent amount, you know, keep him active, feed him well, and they will perform incredible feats of endurance, and they'll be able to out-trek most animals. There's actually been races in the past for distance where a man will race a horse.
Sure.
There was mm-hmm. a famous one. I cannot remember the name or what it was, but where there were these two really wealthy, this was back in the 1800s, and one of them bet the other guy, look, I bet I could go further than your horse can.
Yeah.
And he actually was able to do it. Yeah. And this was back then, and with, you know, just normal amounts of training. So a question I have about, you know, when you're doing that kind of a race, obviously people are going to think, oh, your legs are tired, your body's tired, but there's got to be parts of your body where you're going to be hurting or things that are going to happen, like damage. Like, for example, mm-hmm. the chafing from your shirt yeah. on yeah. your nipples or the freaking, yeah. or,
bleeding,
you know,
nipples.
Yeah. Like
not fun.
Anything weird, you know, that you could talk. Cause I saw in the end of your video that your shoulder, it was just so painful.
Yeah.
Probably from holding in a certain position for so long. I mean,
yeah.
What's that like?
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause you know, it's one of those things where like you go into a 100-mile race and it's like, you know, something's going to come up you didn't expect. It's just a question of when and what will it be, and then how will you respond to it? So like really that's what, when you get these guys who are really, really good, have done a ton of 100-milers, they're the ones who respond best to that uncertainty. When that thing pops up, they're ready to like figure it out, problem solve, and then move on, and then not dwell on it or think like, oh, if that wouldn't have happened, I'd be 5 minutes up faster, or this guy wouldn't have passed me. You know, so like, yeah, that stuff happens all the time. Like, you know, chafing is one that usually, that one doesn't pop up until after you like you like then you realize it's there and it's manifesting, but like then you get in the shower afterwards and all that like, salt starts going over. It's like, the worst shower on earth is the post ultra run shower.
Like, I'm not wiping tonight.
yeah. So you know, I've had you always have interesting things. I know one time I did I was going to do a 100-miler on a track. And I was still living in Wisconsin at the time, so I did a lot of my running on the road, the flat roads, which was good for the whole flat, hard impact type thing. But I didn't do any like running around circles. So when I went out there on the day I was doing the event, I like strained my quad in a weird way from the turning.
Yep. Oh shit. Yeah, so that.
In that one direction, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I've noticed that too. Like there's all these weird little like injuries that kind of either they don't always flare up during the event, but sometimes they'll flare up after. From doing those circles if you haven't kind of adapted to it. So this last time was one of the only times I did it and came out completely unscathed. You know, the days after and everything, no like weird little like niggling things that would be like would pop up afterwards. Yeah. And part of it's because I put my time in on the track. I would do these like 12, 14, 15 mile like progression runs, and then I would turn the direction we're going to turn on the race, the amount of time, like percentage wise, like basically switch you directions every 4 hours. So I thought in my mind, I'm going to be turning left for about 8 hours. I'm going to be turning right for about four. So when I would do those track workouts, I would specify it that way. I would do about two thirds of my laps around in that leftward turn. And then I would do the other one third the opposite way. And I noticed that really helped, especially when I would do speed work around those turns.
Smart, man.
Because that really developed those turning muscles, those leaning muscles, the little ones in like your legs and feet and stuff that could really
cause problems. I wonder how many guys really are taking it to this level, like where you're at.
You would be surprised because from the people who I've met at that train, especially the ultra endurance type athletes, because there's so many of these, think about it this way. If I'm doing like a max lift, or if I'm competing in a 3-minute, you know, wrestling competition or whatever, small little things aren't going to, and when I say small, I mean the tiniest of things don't necessarily come up, but they do when you're doing the same shit over and over again for 11 hours. I mean, that's a fantastic example of, like, we talk about muscle imbalances and recruitment patterns and in people and how over the years they develop into, you know, bigger recruitment pattern, changes.
Yeah,
and
you're talking about something that can happen in 8 hours.
This isn't a fantastic example because, you know, you run in circles or on a track, it's a big track. You're not going to notice any pain. But if you do that for 11 hours, one side of your leg is striking differently than the other side. Mm-hmm. And it's such a small difference that you wouldn't notice unless you did it repetitively.
Yeah, that repetitive stress really adds up.
Yeah,
quickly.
Just over and over and over. And so when I've met ultra endurance athletes, the successful ones tend to be very analytical and intelligent. Mm-hmm. Like they break everything down. Is that an accurate assertion? Or
yeah, there's, I mean, people, whether they do it from a more like a real numbers based analytical approach, or they kind of stumble upon it from a more laid back approach, is kind of what I see. I mean, there's definitely guys who are more along the lines of like, they're not thinking about it. They're not tracking their miles. They're not tracking like all this stuff. They're just going out and they're doing a lot of running. But they along the way, they don't necessarily realize it, but they're developing routines and they're developing like habits that are successful for them. And then they're just kind of doing it from a more, they're kind of hitting it at a different angle. Whereas I'm more along the lines of like, I really, really am interested in the data and the analytics side of things.
I was going to ask you about that because like as far as the adoption of technology, and you see like Strava communities and you see like all these like crazy communities built up now with like apps, you know, attached to all these things. Like how into that are you? And like explain those communities.
Yeah. It's insane. Like, I mean, like Strava, like you said, basically you upload your workout and it will tell you everything you want to know, from your heart rate to like how fast you did a specific little section. It even can get competitive too, where people will build segments where like this is the fastest anyone's ever gone from that spot to that spot.
So competitive.
Yeah. So some people I think will abuse it, and then they'll leave the race out on training with that stuff. But if you kind of know how to like go about it and not make that your focus, unless that is your goal to chase Strava segments,
which there's probably some guys.
There's
always people like that.
Yeah, for sure. But there's a lot of info there, and what I always tell people is, this is good information. This is information you can use, but you have to know where to draw the line. Like if you're using it and it's causing you to overstress and overthink, that's going to be a negative. That's where you've went over the tipping point.
Kind of like a paralysis by analysis.
For sure. And it's the same thing with like with the whole nutrition approach, like I was saying before, people ask me, oh, do you test your ketones? How often are you in ketosis? I'm like, you know, I don't know. I go like in and out of ketosis, and that's part of the thing. I want to be metabolically flexible. So that's my goal, is to be able to go in and out of ketosis. Like, I want to be able to go into a high fat burning mode if I need to, but I also want to be able to tap into carbohydrates. But like, I don't go way out of my way to figure out, oh wow, I was in ketosis for 22 hours that day, but only 21 this day. Because that's just going to cause undue stress. But what I do is I take a little more laid back approach. If I can go out for like a long run where I'm like 5, 6, maybe even 8 hours, and do it on very little fuel, just basically water and electrolytes, then I know I'm fat adapted. I don't have to have a ketone meter right. Tell me that. Like, if, you know, if I'm doing that on like 300 calories, then it's like, yeah, my body's excellent. Able to utilize fat, so I don't have to really worry about whether I'm in this range or that range and stuff like that. So. And it also goes back kind of that thing where, like, using some of those more natural signs as opposed to, like, the deep, like, data. Like, I could, like, draw blood and test ketones every day or test blood sugar and all that stuff. But for me, that's probably taking it maybe one step too far. But yeah. Strava, I love Strava. I definitely geek out on that.
Right. It's funny. I noticed that myself. I went on. I just recently went on a long road trip, and the first part of my road trip was 4 miles. It was supposed to be a 4 mile kayak. Trip to a camping site. It turned out to be 8 miles of kayaking and then another 4 to 6 miles of hiking, which for me is extreme endurance because I don't train that way at all.
Sure.
But I am, for the most part, fat adapted. And I was shocked at how I was okay. Like, I was able to continue doing this kind of like moderate level, long duration of intensity. By the way, I was fasted. I hadn't eaten anything that entire morning because I had planned on eating, you know, that night. And I felt okay, and I wasn't that sore, you know, that the day after. And it's 100% because I was fat adapted. My body was able to tap into that. I was going to ask you, what are your favorite sources of fat?
Oh, dietary fat. So I definitely try to make sure I get, like, I take a very, very, like, whole animal approach where, like, you know, I'll get, like, a chicken and, like, I'll cook it. I'll take the meat off. I'll make a bone broth, you know, and stuff. Like, sometimes I'll even slow cook the bones long enough where you can mash them up and put them in something. So you're really getting, like, you know, all of the stuff, all those like micronutrients and stuff. Excellent. From the animal. So definitely a huge portion of it is, or I wouldn't say huge, but a sizable portion of it's going to be like animal fats. I do a lot of like coconut oil and stuff as well. I think it's like, you know, any medium chain triglyceride is, you know, kind of the king of metabolizing, you know, any sat. I think I mentioned earlier, I try to aim for about half of my fat calories come from saturated at least, because, when you look at it, you know, saturated fat's been demonized, but really it's the one the body prefers to metabolize. It metabolizes quicker than any other one. So when I'm trying to get my body to metabolize fat as quickly and as efficiently as possible, I'm going to want to give it the ones that are going to do that more readily. And that's like, you know, MCTs, coconut oil type things and stuff like that. So that one really finds, you know, other things like extra virgin olive oil, you know, seeds and nuts. I'll get some fat from those too. That's usually probably the bulk of it. Some oils, animal fats, and then seeds, nuts, coconut.
Excellent.
And stuff.
Excellent.
What about marijuana in your community?
Well, no, that's a good question because there's been a lot of outspoken endurance athletes who say that they find benefit from using like an edible or marijuana either to recover or even before a long, you know, training cycle.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak from personal experience as to like whether that would make me faster or not, but I know there's plenty of people who do it in our community, and I'm not sure. Most it's funny because a lot of the folks that are doing it on a regular basis, they're the ones who are a little more laid back about things. So like they're not.
You don't say.
They're not necessarily like, oh yeah. I don't. I think there's very
fine, man.
Very very few, if any. Ultra marathon marijuana users are thinking like, how is this going to help my performance? But that question's been asked, so it's got to be on the back of their mind at this point. And it's really interesting, you know, you hear both sides, and it could be something that, you know, usually ends up being the case where it's very individualistic, where you look at some aspects of it where you got this, you know, increased pain tolerance, you know, like calming effects, great things to have for a 100-mile event. Like, you don't want to be overstressing. You want to be in the moment. You want to like not feel some of that pain. That sounds great. But then the other side of it's like, you know, sitting around on a couch all day and getting lazy, not necessarily.
Right.
So however you respond to it, I suppose, would probably play a pretty big role in that. But yeah, you know, it's a growing field for sure, and especially out here in California where it's more accessible than some other states. And I think you're seeing more and more people play around with it. And you know, part of it too, from like a professional side of things too, is like the legalities in performance and stuff. And you know, currently it's not in the sport of running. I think the rules are like it's fine to use. But you can't use it 6 hours before, during, or 6 hours after an event.
Oh.
So it's like a, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah. No, yeah. It's interesting. I just,
how do they
I
test for that.
That's a good question. Because it stays in your system for so long, but right. I've read a couple articles that, where they're breaking down the whole runner's high, you know, the runner, when people yeah. run for long distances. And, if you talk to runners who are, you know, really good at running, they'll tell you that they hit this time where they, you know, after a certain amount of miles where they get this euphoric feeling. And some scientists are attributing it to the release of endocannabinoids, which are the body's natural cannabinoids, just almost like the ones you find in marijuana, which are phytocannabinoids.
Mm-hmm.
And so those endocannabinoids are released to help improve performance. And so there's some theories going on as to why marijuana may, in fact, improve especially endurance performance, because your body already trying to do that. So
right, I would think those like sub maximal efforts, it could there's probably something there. The high maximum efforts,
no,
is where it's probably gonna,
no, I've tested it. No, it doesn't work with heavy
lifting. We can confirm
no,
maxing out, no.
Does it, what about have you experimented with exogenous ketones at all? And that's a big thing right now, in the, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's an up and coming supplement, and I predict, I've told these guys already, I predict that to be the next big thing. The science really supports it for athletic performance. Have you taken anything like that?
I haven't yet. I actually, it's funny you mentioned it though. I was talking to trying to remember the doctor's name who was kind of like deep into that, who is developing
Dominic D'Agostino.
Maybe it was. Okay. He said I remember, like, I listened to a podcast. I think it was like Ben Greenfield or something, where he was talking about like right now the stuff that actually works, and that doesn't have any kind of like negative side effects is like super expensive, where it'd be like literally thousands of dollars for a bottle of stuff.
Yeah.
But I got an email from a guy a while back saying, like, we're putting this into testing. They wanted to know if I wanted to try some. And I think I emailed back saying yes, but I've got to follow up on that, I guess. Yeah, that'd be cool to play around with.
I've been messing around with the exogenous ketones, and I definitely notice performance boost from taking them.
Okay.
Yeah, you could buy the ketone salts, which are not as effective as the ones that they're testing in studies right
sure.
now. So
mm-hmm.
What about supplements? Do you take any supplements?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I try to do a really, really whole food approach to my training and stuff. But like, you know, I'm also not necessarily doing what a normal person's going to be doing.
I was just going to say, you
great
train
point.
At that level.
Right,
that's when
right.
supplements could definitely
for sure.
benefit.
And it's you know, and my goal is to maximize performance, not necessarily live forever too. So it's like for me, I'm looking for obviously legal things that I can do through my diet and through supplements that are going to help me perform better, recover and stuff like that. You know, I've had a lot of luck with like curcumin extract as an anti-inflammatory. You know, I'll take like omega-3 fatty acid stuff. Not as much as I used to, because now my diet is pretty heavily focused on clean, you know, animal fats, which oftentimes actually do have a substantial amount of omega-3s. That balance between the omega-3s and omega-6 isn't as skewed as it would be if I was eating a ton of, like, you know, the plant fats or like a ton of like really
vegetable
poor,
oils.
Yeah, poorly sourced animal fats where, you know, the cows are in these big slaughterhouses and stuff. So I had that, you know, I work with a company called X Endurance. That's what I'll use on like race day, like the powder for electrolytes and the powder for energy. That's like, it's called Five Fuel and Hydro X. And, you know, those have worked really well for me. The carbohydrate base is kind of like, it's like a steady release. They use like a variety of different of carbohydrate strains. So it's like some are gonna release a little quicker than others, some are gonna release longer. Mm. So I find that you know, if I just kind of trickle that in throughout, like I get that little bit of carbohydrate I need, but it's not like this big sugar bomb all at once and then crash and then bomb and then
sure.
crash.
So it sounds like a staggered approach.
Yeah, for sure.
Fast, medium, slow type
mm-hmm.
of deal.
Yep, okay. yep, yeah. So that stuff's worked, you know. You know, I'm a fan of like Now Foods products, because usually like they can, you don't have to do a whole lot of background homework to find out if their stuff is quality sourced, from my experience anyway.
Sure.
So yeah, like a lot of times when I'll if I want to try something out, I'll go to their site and take a peek at what they got. And
excellent. What about meditation? Do you do anything, any type of mind training or things that help train centering yourself? Because like we had talked about earlier, the mental component is just insane. I can't even imagine it. So I would imagine that would require some kind of training.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting too. Like, I think there's so many different ways to go about that. And it kind of like really depends on the person. Like, you know, people use a variety of things. Like, you know, they'll do like a real structured meditation approach, through prayer, whatever. And, really, really say like, I'm going to actually sit down, like they'll pencil it in their calendar kind of a thing. Whereas other people are more like kind of like let it happen as it happens, which I kind of do more of, I think, because like it tends to happen. I think a lot of people, they get so stressed out that it just won't naturally happen unless they kind of like consciously go after it. But for me, like I do so much like aerobic based training, like I find myself kind of drifting into that state oftentimes when I'm working out, or, you know, when I do a fair amount of driving as well, with stopping in and doing like, you know, the footwear clinics and stuff like that. So like I find myself having those quiet times where it's just me, you know, by myself driving. And as long as the traffic isn't too hectic, I can usually get pretty calm and meditative there. San Francisco at 5 o'clock, not so much, but
no way.
Well, I can totally relate to that, 'cause we talked about this on an episode one time, and we did a whole thing on that. And I said that, you know, for me, it's meditative to actually even be like, I'll have something, listening to a podcast, yeah. I'll be walking my dogs, and there actually becomes a point where I'll forget that I just went like five blocks. I forgot what houses I passed because I'm so just kind of in the moment.
Just in that, yeah.
And to me, that's meditative. Like somebody would try and debate that and argue that you're not, you know, in the silence, dark room or like that. But I think...
No, you're right, Adam. I actually talked to a friend of mine who's huge into meditation. And I disagreed with you at first. I thought, no, that's not... You don't have to sit down and meditate.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she said, no. She said, he's right. You can meditate at any given moment. And it's literally being... in the moment, you know, and so that what we just talked about is meditating.
And right. I find for me, like, that's the only way it works. I feel if I sit down and like say, okay, I'm going to meditate right here, there's like this pressure to like get meditative, right? And then I'm thinking like, fuck, I gotta go handle this. I need to go do this. I forgot I didn't do this yet. I gotta pay this bill. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's why a change of environment a lot of times is really helpful for me. Mm-hmm. And I talked a lot about, you know, getting into nature and like getting away from like the hustle and bustle of like, you know, other people and jobs and like cars and all this kind of stuff, because it helps to kind of like slow everything down and realize, you know, where you are as far as like where you are in space. So yeah, that helps a lot.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that though, because I was talking to a guy the other day and he said the exact same thing, where he actually had dealt with like depression and stuff in the past, and if he gives himself that super quiet mode, he like sinks into a bad place where he starts thinking about the negative things. He thinks about the past. He thinks about, oh, what about the future that I don't know, where he needed to get into the now and just kind of enjoy the moment. And he said the same thing. He would, you know, he would listen to podcasts or listen to music, because that would really cause him to kind of open his mind and start thinking like, especially if it was a podcast that's discussing a topic that he's interested in. And he's like opening his mind and trying to understand something. He's very much just like slowly absorbing it and not like freaking out or thinking about things he didn't really need to be thinking about. And
that's got to be totally, and you bring up the individual thing, right? Like our type of personalities we have, you know. I feel like, because I know other people that are opposite, you know, that's, they have this ritual, they get up and they claim that this sitting with their legs crossed in the room dark and they can just get into this deep, and I'm like, I've tried that. I mean, I grew up in a very religious home, so prayer was a very natural, normal thing. And you know, I have the ADD mind where I'm in, close my eyes, put me in a room, and I'm thinking about everything but what I'm supposed to be probably thinking about, where, you know, get me into something I'm very interested, very relaxed or calming for me that I've done a million times, or a song that I love to listen to, or a podcast, like you said, that I'm just totally in the conversation, like I'm there. It totally settles me down. So
now, anything on meal frequency for you, is that even important to you? Does that matter? Like, you know, I need to eat so many times a day or not eat so many times a day?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I find the more dialed in I get, the easier it gets, because you can start to kind of just trust your body signals. Like,
he sounds like me, doesn't he?
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's really funny. Like, as a society, we kind of like we strap ourselves down with these meal times and stuff like that, where for me, it's like I wake up in the morning, and if I'm going to go for a long run, if I'm hungry, I'll eat something. If I'm not, I won't. And, you know, that'll vary. Usually I'm not hungry in the morning. So, you know, I'll have some coffee, maybe a little bit of raw honey or some coconut milk in there or something like that. And, you know, then I'll go out and run. And then I'll come back and I'll eat when I'm hungry. And, you know, like I said before, it's sometimes I'm hungry like as soon as I step in the door. Other times it takes a little bit. So I definitely kind of take a little more less structured approach to that. But I got there because of the structure. Like when I started, I couldn't do that. Like, you know, I came off of a nutritional approach for me that was like sending all these poor signals. So like, you know, I was always hungry, or I was always, you know, the thing I always say was the weirdest thing is like, at night I'd eat a big meal and like my stomach would be full, but I'd still be hungry. Mm-hmm. It was like this weirdest feeling. It's like, it shouldn't match or they should match differently. So now it's different than that. Like, you know, if my body craves a carbohydrate, I'm usually thinking, well, I probably went really low carb and did a harder effort and, you know, didn't replace the glycogen fast enough. And my body's saying, hey, man, if you're going to do that again in the next 5 hours, you should probably, you know, have like some melon or berries or something like that. Or more often than not, I find like, you know, it either like in the afternoon, if I didn't eat big meal earlier, at evening, my appetite will start to spike and I'll start craving like savory things, you know, like. You know, is it steak or something like that, you know, and then I'll kind of give myself what I feel I need.
Well, I tell you what, man, it's been a great time talking to you. I mean, you answered the questions excellent, but a lot of the stuff you said is, I think, very different from what people might expect someone like yourself to say. You obviously know your stuff, very, very smart, and your approach to your performance and fitness really matches the approach that we try to preach a lot about, mm-hmm. listening to the signals of your body.
Sure.
And I love seeing people who can perform at a very high level, mm-hmm. who also have that approach, because people, I think that you can't. You have to, if you have a high level of performance, you have to follow this approach, which is super structured, super eat, you know, so many times a day. And,
yeah.
you know, and it's like this horrible, neurotic, like, way to live.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the way you're doing it, you know, we it's probably the best way to do it for longevity as well. So
for sure.
Yeah, what he brings up too, which I love to hear him say, is that, you know, at the very beginning of all this, there was lots of tracking and paying attention to these, learning to connect these signs.
Of course. It's a learning process.
Yeah, you know, and that we talk a lot about that also, is expressing to people that, you know, I don't count my, if I'm not competing, if I'm just eating, or I don't watch and count my shit. Like, I know what makes me feel a certain way. And and you, Scott, you said something, I've said this a bunch of times too, is that normally when you have that feeling, I know, oh, I probably didn't get as much fat as I should have got yesterday, and I tapped out of my carbs, is why I feel, why I'm all of a sudden craving this. And either I'll replenish it with two or three cups of berries and stuff, or I'll go have a big old fatty steak meal, you know,
yeah.
like I've learned over time, but it took the pain at tracking and paying attention, right? I mean, it takes that paying attention to that and connecting those dots, and then it really isn't that hard once you kind of put that together, you know. Very, very cool.
Yeah, thanks again. It's been excellent.
Yeah, awesome having you, Zach.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. If we like your review and we pick it, you will win a free Mind Pump t-shirt. You can also find us at Mind Pump Radio. You can find me at Mind Pump Sal, Justin at Mind Pump Justin, Adam at Mind Pump Justin. Of course, that's all on Instagram. And you can check out our programs.
You did it the third time.
I did. And you can find us on online at mindpumpmedia.com.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic. 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now, plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy.
Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.